This is KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. I begin with a quote from Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. You have the power to strip away many superfluous troubles located wholly in your judgment, and to possess a spacious room for yourself, embracing in thought the whole cosmos, to consider everlasting time, to think of the rapid change in the parts of each thing, of how short the span is from birth until dissolution, and how the void before birth and after dissolution are equally infinite. The spacious room Aurelius refers to is the mind, which can embrace in thought the whole cosmos. How is that possible? Is mind in the cosmos, or is cosmos in the mind? It's the preposition that befuddles us. Maybe mind and cosmos are not containers, but something else altogether. A ligature of birth and void, a love affair that takes place somewhere that is not aware, an energy transfer or excitation of the quantum field. Silence must be heard. Time has from the clock will turn. But silence, there's the right to feel. Marcus Aurelius speaks of everlasting time as well as the short span between birth and death. The relation between mind and time is as elusive as the relation between being and time. All I know is that I spend a lot of time in my own mind and in the minds of the authors I read, as well as the minds of friends and loved ones. Where there's mind, there's a fold in the cosmic connective tissue. Andrew Marvell wrote, "The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace." That's not true of the mind. A lot of embracing between mind and cosmos takes place there. As for the mind's relation to the body, who knows? My body has a mind of its own and relates to the cosmos in its own cellular ways. All this to say that the mind is utterly mysterious, reaching well beyond even the most spacious rooms, and no one really knows just how far beyond our ken it extends. Some know more than others, however, and that's why I'm pleased to welcome to the show today a guest who has thought long and hard about some of these issues, and who has spent a lot of time practicing and teaching mind expansion through the techniques of meditation. Crystal Cassidy is the founder and CEO of SoulPod, an inner technology platform exploring how structured ritual, breathwork, and contemplative practice can shape perception and behavior. Her frameworks connect neuroscience, somatic practice, and philosophy to better understand how shifts in consciousness influence human potential. Crystal's path began with early training in martial arts and meditation, which later converged with a nearly two-decade career in biotechnology and oncology research. She worked across pharmaceutical programs, genomic diagnostics, and helped build the clinical research operations that supported the first blood-based diagnostic for solid tumor cancers as director of clinical operations. She is also trained in multiple contemplative disciplines, including meditation, kriya, and energy-based modalities, integrating them into practical frameworks for nervous system regulation and inner transformation. And if that's not enough, she is particularly interested in consciousness as something trainable, and in how meditative and contemplative practices can serve as real mechanisms not only for personal transformation, but for the kind of species-level evolution that becomes possible when humans learn to access, stabilize, and work with expanded states of consciousness. Crystal Cassidy, welcome to Entitled Opinions. I'm delighted you could join us today.
I am so happy to be here today with you, Robert. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. Let me state at the outset that I have never practiced meditation in any formal sense, and I'm sure that the same applies to many of our listeners. So could I ask you to start by telling us what exactly meditation is in your view and what kind of meditation you practice?
Yeah, and we could spend the whole episode on this question, really, of what is meditation? And I think the best way to frame it, given the beautiful foundation that you just set with this concept of the mind and the cosmos, it's really the process by which we expand the aperture of our mind to be able to experience and perceive more mind or quantum field or God or consciousness, awareness. So it's really the process of opening that aperture and then closing it back to your foundational level of consciousness, opening it again until you start to notice that foundational level of mind start to shift.
So you ask in the notes you provided me whether it's a modality, lineage, a process, or an experience. So these are words that might need a little bit of fleshing out. Is there a way in which meditation can be a modality?
I think it's all of the above.
All of the above, yeah.
Yeah. Meditation, the root of that word coming from to ponder, to reflect. But it's really, in Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, that's so perfectly titled because he really is reflecting on life and the mind and all of these concepts. But meditation as a practice is this exploration into consciousness. Mm-hmm. And we often see this concept of light come into the conversation, of bringing more light. That's why I like the word aperture, of opening that up so right. that we can see more.
There are different types of meditations, I gather, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And many. Everybody many has strong time. Opinions on right. which one's the best.
Is there a common root to them all?
I would say there's two main buckets of meditation as a modality. The first one being focused. So you can put many different approaches of meditation into the focused bucket. So this is if you're Vipassana, you're noticing the breath in and out through your nostril. As you inhale, you're noticing the coolness. As you exhale, you're noticing the warmth. It's visualization, it's mantra work. This is all using the mind to focus into something so that we're disrupting the present repetitive patterns that we have. And we're starting to introduce a new way of perceiving. And then there's the bucket of unfocused, which is a little bit harder to put words to. But this is when you release the mind as far as focusing it into one thing, and you kind of fall back into consciousness. It's a surrendered experience. In martial arts, we call it mind of no mind. Mokso is the warrior's meditation, which is Zen-based, and that's really where I started just about 30 years ago. And this is the kind of surrendered part of meditation, and you're falling back into it and expanding into that intelligence, which will catch you. And that's really a deep exploration.
So on the focus part, you can focus on anything. Mm-hmm. It's almost irrelevant what you choose to focus on. And then with the falling back into consciousness, how do you understand consciousness? Because when I think of the mind, I don't first and foremost think of consciousness. I think of thought.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I suppose this is what you might consider a discursive way of thinking, although I'm not sure it's discursive. It's much more discursive when I have to express inner thoughts in writing or verbally, like I'm trying to do now. Is falling back into consciousness falling back into a void, or are you falling back into something that actually has some noetic or, you know, intellectual content?
To just back up a little bit from there, my favorite definition of meditation is to become familiar with. And I like that open-endedness to that phrase, because as you pointed out, the first thing you're becoming familiar with is thought.
Yeah.
And we have 70,000 to 90,000 thoughts a day. Most of those are repetitive. Most of those are negative. And so that's quite the beast to become aware of, especially at first. And that's why it is such a challenge. And the meditation can be anything but calm when you first get into it. Right. And then you start to become aware of more and the subconscious and the superconscious. So to answer your question about falling back into this awareness that is aware, it sits behind the thought and in between the thoughts. Yeah. That's what you're surrendering and falling back into.
So there are terms here that bleed into one another, mm-hmm. consciousness, mind. There's also ego. I think ego plays a big role in the practice of meditation, and something that you call energy body.
Oh, yeah.
But maybe we could talk first a little bit about ego. I'm very curious. Is one of the purposes of meditation to liberate the mind from its ego attachments?
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, ego, bad.
Awareness, good.
Awareness, good, right?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah, something like that. There's a lot of nuance to this conversation around ego, because there's been, especially culturally, so much conversation around ego death. And there's different opinions about this in the spiritual communities and lineages. So I'll offer a few of them. One of them is that, you know, the ego is a sense of self. So it's the roles that we've taken on. It's anything that we use to construct our sense of self. We're good at this, we're bad at this. The ego loves hierarchy. It's always trying to find its position. Yeah. And a lot of
people... It's very invested in its own status.
Oh, yes.
Prestige.
Yeah. You know, when you're starting to meditate, you're becoming aware of all of these elements of the ego. And from a yogic perspective, it's a little bit different in that there's three types of ego. The first being exclusive ego. And this is really what Tolle is talking about in his work. And this is the very...
Tolle,
yeah. Eckhart Tolle. Love him.
Can you tell our audience who he is?
Yeah. So he's written a book called The New Earth. He's done some amazing work on presence.
Uh-huh.
And he's a philosopher in his own right. And he, I think, explains the mechanics of the ego in a really powerful way. So check out that book.
So three types of ego.
So exclusive ego, which is the self, which is all of the different roles, everything that you think about you. Then there's we call this more of like the inclusive ego. This is when you start to realize in the shift from belief to knowing that we are connected in some way. And so that's a real shift for the ego as a entity, as a construct. And then there's this more of like a cosmic oneness ego. So the yogis don't really look at it as the name to get rid of the ego, because it grounds us into our human experience. If you're here, you have elements of it. The goal, rather, is to learn how to become aware of your ego so that you can use it for your benefit, not your detriment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did a show of not too long ago on the unselfing of the self. And I think
that
the ego probably is what that self is referring to when you're mm-hmm. talking about the unselfing of it. Yeah. So meditation does not flirt much with Freudian psychoanalytic theory, I'm assuming, where you have the id, the ego, and the superego. These categories sound a little bit alien to what you're describing, no?
I'm sure they have some intersections. The id, remind me, that's like the sense of...
That's really what's taking place in the unconscious, and it has to do with a lot of impulses that have to do with drives,
mm-hmm.
and primordial emotions, and
that
everything that the ego or the psyche, the human psyche, has to keep restrained mm-hmm. and under control, because if the id gets out of control, then it has no regard for others. You can't live in a community, or let alone a society or civilization, mm-hmm. if the id, you know, gains ascendancy over.
Yeah, there is some intersection there in that. The deeper you go into meditation, the definition of becoming familiar with the subconscious is something that you start to turn the light on. And I liken it to a cave.
Right.
I like to think about Plato's cave. But you're turning that light just a little bit more on, and you're starting to see things that you didn't realize were there. Motivations, behaviors, drives, elements of self that are quite frankly hard to sometimes face. that you really can't go deep into meditation and not turn that light on and start to become aware of it. And over time, that light starts to bring more of the subconscious into the conscious mind. So there starts to be like a transfer there, which is really interesting. Yeah.
I gather, again, it's my impression, but correct me if I'm wrong, that the trajectory of meditation is ultimately an ascent into a higher levels of consciousness, into the light, into an enlightenment, and that we've done a lot of shows, you know, about the descent, not into light, but into darkness. There's this idea of it going down into the subconscious. That can be also a terrifying confrontation with a lot of demons and monsters. And did a show recently also on Carl Jung, where we discussed, you know, the Red Book and the years that he spent descending into a condition of madness, essentially of a madness that he was able to control, you know, being a psychologist as he was, but really dangerous stuff, as far away from enlightenment as in the meditation sense that you can get. So is that descent into the cave a precondition for ascending into the light? And if it is, then it sounds very much like Dante's Divine Comedy to me, which begins with the descent through hell and then slowly makes its way out into the light and up into the heavens. So,
yeah, it's a great question. And I think the answer is it's a descent and an ascent. That's the aperture opening and closing.
Yeah.
And sometimes that closing is pretty dark.
Yes.
And you're facing the subconscious and you're facing emotions that you didn't know were there. And, you know, we can even take that, this might be a stretch for your audience, but into past lives and beyond time.
Yes.
And becoming aware of more. And when you become aware of more, it's the yin and the yang. It's the light and the dark. Yeah. And you're able to hold it if you're grounding it into the heart space, which is...
That's, okay, ground it where? You say heart space, but what is that? Is it...
Yeah. The heart space, so in the ways that I have come to really orient around this is that there's three brains to this spiritual body. We talk about the gut brain, the heart brain, and the head brain. And there needs to be balance between the three. And it's also, we talk about the lower triangle and the upper triangle of the energetic body. And in our culture right now, we're very overemphasized on the head brain. It has its powers and it's needed. But we've become disconnected to this heart brain, this vulnerability, which really does become a power. And so accessing more of that space, and you can feel it viscerally when you're in it, to allow that to open, you'll always be held even when you're in the midst of the dark.
Yeah.
And so that's what you ground into when you're facing those difficult elements. And sometimes you don't know the story behind those difficult elements. They're simply there and present. And a lot of meditation is learning to sit in that discomfort and to welcome it and not push against it so that you can experience it fully. And you'd be amazed how you move through that with a lot more ease.
Do you intend these terms analogically or has a physiological basis so that the brain is an organ and does the thinking for it. The heart is an organ and the gut, as you say,
it's an intelligence.
Are you pointing to real organic partitions of the body or are you just speaking metaphorically?
Both. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We can get into this. It's a little bit further out there conversation around the energy body.
And yeah, what is that energy body?
Energy body is the Sushumna. That's the central channel that's following the spinal channel. So there's a biological basis. And a lot of what we're talking about is areas where there's nerve plexi. And there's a concentration of energy there. And we know from the heart space, the recent research, that it has quite the field, bigger than the brain, that extends from the body. And this... You know, chakras, energy centers, whatever you want to call them, they're these intersections where many lines of your energy meet physically and non-physically. And you can start to bring those online. That's the awakening process. That's the self-realization. That's the the enlightenment process is this whole system coming online, all of the intelligence or brains of the body coming online. And that's it's a physiological process, it's a mental process, it's emotional, and a spiritual process.
Somehow I prefer this tripartite thing to the three egos, and I'm sure they're intimately related, but I like the idea that we have different centers of gravity within our own spiritual bodies, which are bodies.
Right.
They're not just disembodied spirit at all. Mm-hmm. And so in the practice of meditation, it sounds like, you know, the initiate has to go through very many different stages. And as you, as a teacher and, a master of meditation, I suppose you need to either do one-on-one sessions with your, what do you call them?
Students.
Students. Mm-hmm. Call them students, yeah. Or group sessions. But if you're going to do a group session, everyone has to be more or less at the same stage of enlightenment? Or can the initiate, follow one of your sessions along with, with people who have been doing it for many years and have confronted a lot of things that the initiate hasn't?
Yeah. And I'm also a forever student. I'm constantly learning and expanding in this path. It doesn't have a destination. It's forever expansion. But, interestingly, I've found with students in individual and in group settings, we each have our own energetic constitution. Every single person has a unique element, energy, consciousness that is coming forward. And I've learned to not expect anything from students. And sometimes somebody who's rather new to it can take to it in ways that somebody who's been going into this realm for a long time, and neither is right or wrong. So I tend to remain very open with students as far as what they're capable of. And I tend to really point them to their own intuition about what they want to take on and what they're not ready to take on. Mm-hmm. But one-on-one is very powerful. Group sessions are also very powerful. And of course, there is that element in group sessions where you can start to feel people syncing up in a way. And there's some really interesting things that can happen.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine there's a lot of intersection of energy. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
So, Crystal, a few terms, if you don't mind, because they're not quite familiar to me. Mm-hmm. Prana, ki.
Chi.
Chi, but yeah. Chi, ki, chi.
Yeah.
Mana, life force, kundalini.
Kundalini, yeah.
Okay, prana.
Prana, we'll start there. Prana is energy. It's this life force, and you'll find this in the Vedas. It's moving and connecting everything. So I liken it to the quantum field in some ways.
Yeah,
and it's same for chi. It's same for mana from the Hawaiian indigenous people. It's this connective tissue of the universe that we can access, that we always are accessing, but we can start to direct that access. Kundalini is something that I've spent quite a bit of time with, and that means, kunda means coil. Lini, you can say like a straightening or a line. And this is pointing to this system that I'm talking about. I really do think it's a technology, and it's a latent system. And the kundalini is like a coiled snake at the base of your energetic channel. And this can uncoil. And this is the kundalini awakening.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know about the meaning of all these words, but it sounds like in my intro, I had some kind of intuitive sense when
you
I speak about a fold in the connective cosmic tissue or,
absolutely.
Some kind of...
You'll see this symbology. I was just in Egypt, and you'll see the snake coiled and then uncoiled.
Right.
It's across many different cultures, and it's really pointing to that awakening.
So what do we know about meditation's impact on the body?
Mm-hmm. We're
talking here about the body in the ordinary sense. I mean, here you mentioned nervous system, brain, endocrine, the cellular level.
Yeah. I mean, meditation was really considered pretty woo-woo up until about 20 years ago when these studies first started coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And Shout out to California and the universities here, because they pioneered a lot of this research. And even in the last year, I think it's the UC San Diego study, looked at new meditation students over a 1 week period. And we see statistically significant shifts in the brain. So this is prefrontal cortex. This is the hippocampus, which is like the indexer where we store memory, where we process memory, the amygdala, which is our fight, flight, freeze, fawn response. These areas are being impacted by these meditation retreats. So you have short-term impacts, which are pretty impressive to see that so quickly. And then you have longer-term meditation impacts. And we see systemic shifts in cortisol, in DHEA. We see longer cellular life cycles. So the telomeres on the end of your chromosomes are actually longer in meditators. So I find that fascinating. This is just in the last few years. And we also see metabolic shifts, anti-inflammatory shifts. So there's systemic shifts going on for people who meditate that can compete with pharmaceutical interventions. Hmm. So it's really quite amazing.
Would the same apply to something as every day as exercise, which is physical exercise, not mental exercise?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In some ways, maybe.
Yeah.
But I think there's something happening in the brain in this relationship to the nervous system, this interplay between the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. And that trigger point into the sympathetic nervous system is getting raised.
Yeah.
And so you'll see people with anxiety who are typically breathing high up in the lungs here, they start to drop that breath down into the lower lungs. You see their CO2 levels shift over time. So yes, physical exercise has its benefits, absolutely. But I think meditations are slightly different.
The role of breath fascinates me.
Mm.
I think I did a show not too long ago, I think. Anyway, it's, we just stayed in water and were then born into air. And from the moment we're born to the day we die, we are taking in this invisible substance without any awareness of it. And yet it is the very substance of life itself. So there's a lot of emphasis on drawing attention or awareness to the simple activity of breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And so shifting the level at which the intake of breath occurs, I gather it has a lot of effects on the entire nervous system. Is that what you're saying to us?
Yeah, it's one of the most powerful modalities in meditation. That's why just about every type of meditation has some element of breath work incorporated in it. And it's really fascinating how these types of breath work will evolve the more that you spend time with them. Even the triangle breath, the three-legged breath, inhaling for a count of 5, 10, or 20, and then exhaling for that same count, inhaling, the hold, the top, exhaling, inhaling, hold. Playing with that breath for a few months at a time will reveal elements of your consciousness to you. It sounds simple, it's very profound. And yes, it has a pretty big impact on the nervous system. You're starting to influence what we thought was automatic. And we're starting to have a little bit more control over that, even to the degree to where monks can change their body temperature through the breath. So something that we thought was not influenceable, it was not changeable, we're discovering is we have a little bit more control over. And it helps to open up and rewire those neurological pathways.
Yeah. Well, I know from physician friends of mine that people who meditate, they can drop their blood pressure by 30 points if they're just taking 5 minutes and meditating on it.
Yeah.
So it clearly, I think, it seems like the body comes along on this journey that meditation entails. No?
Mm-hmm.
One way of thinking of meditation is as a way of freeing yourself from the shackles of the body. But it sounds to me from what you're saying that it's more of a transfiguration of the somatic as such. that takes place through the meditative process.
Yeah, I like that.
And that the body comes along with
it does
with the mind, or the body is, you know, the body is a.
It'll fight you a little bit.
Yeah.
It'll fight you at the beginning, but you do develop a new relationship with the body.
Yeah. So we have these different phases of awakening of the body. And then, so this raises a question, Crystal, about, you know, the why.
Mm-hmm.
And there has to be a why in, I guess, the students who come to you. Mm-hmm. There's a reason,
mm-hmm.
you know, why they want to do meditation. And you think that's important to establish at the beginning or raise the student's consciousness about why they're doing this in the first place. Is that right?
Yeah. And I think we've talked about a bit of that, which is understanding the scientific components, I think, is helpful because you're understanding, okay, why am I doing this breath work?
Yeah.
You're doing this to shift your nervous system, to start to build new neurological pathways. I think it goes beyond that because meditation has really been marketed as this tool to calm and stress reduction, which it is 100%. What I find is that the why has to be bigger than that.
Yeah.
And it has to be something around transformation because that's really why we're doing meditation is to understand ourselves, our position in the universe and consciousness. Is it linear? Is it nonlinear? You know, and I find for me personally, my why is to fully self-realize in this lifetime to my greatest capacity. That's why I meet my cushion every morning for the last decade. And that propels me forward. It's the most important part of my day. And so I find that if students can connect to something that is that big and inspiring to them, then this becomes not a checkbox that you're just checking every day that you've done your meditation. It becomes really a way of life to more deeply connect with life. And I think that goes a long way.
And do you believe that there's wrong ways of doing meditation?
I don't think there's a wrong way. Everybody meets meditation for different reasons. Sometimes it's for healing, physical healing, mental healing, stress, anxiety. That's how you first meet it. And there are all kinds of different modalities, and I'm very hesitant to say one is better than the other because if everybody has different energetic constitutions, then they're going to need different tools, different entry points.
Yeah.
And so I would take it back to those two different types of meditations, which is the focused versus the unfocused.
Right.
And if they fit into those, even prayer. Prayer is a type of focused meditation.
Mm-hmm.
You're devoting yourself to an avatar or to something or to a concept. That is a type of meditation, but it's not necessarily an unfocused.
Yeah. Well, Martin Heidegger, the philosopher, made a distinction, you know, he insisted on it, especially later Heidegger, between calculative thinking and meditative thought.
Mm.
And it sounds like what he meant by meditative thought was very much like a falling back into a consciousness where you allow things to release. Use the term releasement. Becoming receptive and a kind of willful suspension of the will.
Mm.
And I think so much of our anxiety, stress, and misery really comes from the compulsions of willfulness, which are connected to ego and what we were discussing earlier. And I wonder if the will as a faculty, a psychic faculty, enters into your thinking about meditation.
Mm.
About how we can suspend the willfulness of the will, which is always driving us.
Always driving.
Yeah.
Ambition. Yeah, I think that's the surrendered moment, which is really hard to put words to until you experience it.
Right.
And to your point, it's the surrendering of will, of directing something, of controlling something. And this is the meeting the void, the unknown. You know, if the quantum field is pure possibility, then that means there's a degree of faith and trust that all spiritual traditions talk about. And that becomes a requirement for that releasing of the will. And that's it's incredible. Once you experience that, there's no going back. There's a shift from belief to knowing, of what surrender is, of what that state of consciousness is, that awareness. And they're really, to your point, it's interesting because when you're in that, the experience or the thought is the experience. There's no separation. And the will tends to exist in the separation.
Yeah. Yeah. So some of the challenges that you are bound to run into if you're a student, you know, with meditation, you talk about there's plateaus, resistance, anxiety, time. I'm interested in time and how you move. So I guess, you know, in psychoanalysis, they have the theory that there's when you're starting to get close to, you know, the probing the complex and you have this resistance. But I think resistance here means something else. Is it a resurgence of the will into the process of trying to suspend the willfulness? Because it's a loss of control. When you say surrender, a loss of control is quite terrifying.
Yeah, until it isn't.
Until it isn't. I suppose I suppose we're all hardwired to...
For the known.
The known and control.
Yeah.
So you encounter a lot of resistance sometimes when that moment is drawing near?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because resistance is always a part of the process. I've been doing this for a long time. I still hit resistance. The difference is you learn how to move through it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And even the great yogis, there's some just awesome stories about them being challenged in their experience and taking that moment to recalibrate. And so I think knowing that resistance is part of the journey can help soften the anxiety that can come up when you hit it. And it's multifaceted. So when you're first starting out, you're becoming familiar with the conscious mind, like I said, which is quite the thing to become aware of. And the body, usually the body's really leading the mind in a lot of ways until you start to become aware of that relationship and you're switching the roles so that the body's following your mind. And it's almost like a wild animal of sorts. You know, it's going to fight you along that path until it doesn't. And it starts to just kind of surrender to the mind. At this point, when I go into meditation, my body just kind of has me until I get back. And it's a really fascinating evolution of that relationship with body and mind. And then, of course, you have the mental resistance as well. And what I do find is that, to your point, what you just said, it tends to get heightened right before breakthrough.
Yeah.
That's what I tell students. So stay with it. And right on the other side of that is something big.
Yeah.
9 times out of 10, 10 times out of 10.
Well, we don't have to get into this very thorny issue, but when you say that the body directs the mind, and then at a certain point, one of the objectives is to reverse the relationship, is meditation founded on a supposition of dualism? Is it dualistic in its metaphysics, or if I can use that word, or its philosophy? Are the body and mind separate entities, or are they ultimately inseparable, but we just haven't reached that moment of integration?
My opinion on it is that it's both and.
Yeah.
There is obviously a relationship. There's a connection here. But this term, die before you die, is pointing to this kind of death of the self before you physically die. And when we physically die, the physical body is not necessarily coming along with us. But our consciousness, that awareness that is aware, is moving on. So
beyond death.
Beyond death. And so we do drop the physical body at some point. But while we're here, we're one and the same. We have this energetic relationship. There is consciousness within our body. So it's a really interesting question to contemplate.
So there's a traditional dictum in philosophy that philosophy is learning how to die. And would you say meditation is a means of reconciling us to our mortality?
So yes, absolutely.
And does it do that by positing that the moment of death, biological death, physical death, is not the end, but that there's continuation, except in a purely mental, non-corporeal way?
Mm-hmm. The ego doesn't come along.
The ego doesn't come along. So what is it that goes along?
That awareness.
It's awareness, mind, consciousness. Yeah. There are all these different words we've been putting into play during our conversation. Well, that's very enlightening, Crystal. Thank you. Come to the end of our time, but I want to thank you for enlightening us, really, for those of us who know many people who do meditate, because a great many people practice meditation. But there's a lot of us who have yet, you know, to take up that project. And it's been very helpful to learn from the inside, you know, what the objectives are and what the processes are and the methods and so forth. So thanks again. I want to remind our listeners, we've been speaking with Crystal Cassidy, who is can I call you a Zen master?
Meditation master, sure.
Meditation master. Crystal Cassidy, a meditation master who works out of San Francisco.
I do, yeah.
And it's been a pleasure to have you on Entitled Opinions.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm Robert Harrison. Thanks for listening.
Turn off the light. Take a deep breath and relax. Start to move slowly, very slowly. Let the rhythm be your guiding light.